He's one of Northern Ireland's best-known singers. Brian Kennedy has just released his 10th studio album, Voice, recently appearing as a coach on The Voice Ireland. He's also one of the few openly gay celebrities from Northern Ireland. Born in the 1960s on the Falls Road in Belfast, he's gone on to perform on stage with world-famous artists across the globe. I've been speaking to Brian about his life and career, and I start by asking him if he remembers growing up during the Troubles.
The better question is, would you forget them? You know, that's the thing. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that you would never, ever, ever forget. And in fact, it's interesting, as I get a little older these days, even though I'm not that old, but at the same time, I'm not a great one for looking back, but given that things are changing so radically, and even more recently, as you know, I sang in the Jubilee celebrations for the Queen and Stormers, and I met her when Martin McGuinness came in the Lyric Theatre to do the famous handshake and everything. So, of course, I'm surrounded by huge examples of how much we've moved on, and it makes me look back at how things were in the beginning.
Were you a happy young man growing up?
Yes and no, in the sense that, of course, like any child, you just cope with your surroundings and your environment. But certainly, no, there was a lot to be unhappy about. It was a very scary time. We lived very much in the moment. It still was in the grip of the Catholic Church, as you know, and that kind of thing. And that was kind of a scary theatre all by itself, never mind actually being on the street and having to encounter the army and explosions and neighbours losing their legs. And, you know, I saw someone shot dead in front of me. I've talked about that before.
What happened?
So, yeah, it was a very scary time.
Well, hold on, what age were you when that happened? Someone was shot dead in front of you?
Yeah, I'd say probably about 9 or 10 or 11, around that kind of age.
Where were you, out in the street?
I was out in the street. I was outside my friend's house in Beechmead Avenue. And you know, as is always, you can kind of tell, it's like even in nature when you see certain things and all the birds all shut up, you know, there's a kind of a weird silence that happens, and then someone just literally tore around the corner off the Falls Road into Beechmount, where I'm from, and ran past us. And 2 seconds behind him came a soldier who then took a stance and then shot the guy in the back dead. So the guy fell flat onto his face because he'd been shot from the back. And then everything, as you can imagine, erupted. And I remember that was maybe a few yards in front of me. And I remember, first of all, I couldn't believe how loud the guns were. And second of all, you just can't believe what you're seeing. It's like you're watching a film, but you're not. You're actually seeing it.
Did you know the person?
I didn't know the person at all. And in fact, the weird thing that happened next was that a few neighbours along, the girl thought it was her husband. And she ran out screaming and kicking and, you know, all that. And then she turned him over, only to discover it wasn't her husband. And she immediately just stopped, like someone turning off a tap. She just stopped being hysterical and just went back to the house like, oh, thank God, it's not him. And then, of course, all hell broke and the army came in then to take the body away. An ambulance was trying to get there, all of that. So, I mean, all we could do was kind of watch from an unsafe distance.
Did that affect, Brian, your view on the British Army or the British?
Well, I think that certainly what that does to a little human being is it hollows you out, and you maybe feel things more deeply than you would have done if you just had a regular childhood and all you had to contend with were things like the football and those kinds of things. But yeah, absolutely, it changes everything for sure.
Well, how did you feel about the army since then?
Well, the army were just like a constant presence. They were someone to be afraid of. They were someone to be very wary of. They were the people that we encountered on the way to school every morning. So, for example, they would like look down the butt of the gun and follow you across the street like they were pointing at you and using you for target practice.
So you would have said, were you anti-British?
No, I wouldn't say I was. Interesting enough, I would not say that because I just had this... we were certainly anti-feeling... I was anti-feeling afraid, but I didn't grow up in a house like that. Like, my father was an athlete. He had lots of Protestant friends, things like that, but we knew to keep quiet about that. It's really amazing, actually, because in some senses I had every opportunity and every excuse to be that kind of person. But for some reason, I just was dealing with the thing in front of me, which was this kind of army in their, bizarrely, ironically, their camouflage uniforms that made them stick out beyond belief. They weren't camouflaged at all. And it was just, it was just kind of dealing with what's in front of you. So I wouldn't say so.
I was asking how difficult or how easy was it to grow up in Belfast at the time. Yeah. You were growing up in a Catholic household as a young gay man.
Yes, indeed, exactly. And of course, not having, a fully understanding of that, but certainly having an understanding that there was something, you know, as they say, I wasn't like the other boys, you know, so... From the get-go, I think the thing that you realise is that it's nearly impossible to be heterosexual, never mind any other kind of sexuality. And again, there's that wonderful underlying language that happens in the Catholic Church which is that either they will then say from the pulpit and damn homosexuals to hell, or you just, you know that there's kind of an underlying disapproval, there's an underlying thing that you just can't truly be who you are. So you spend, I certainly spent most of my childhood covering that up, avoiding the truth that eventually came out later on. But yeah, I suppose it was a double whammy, all right, Stephen.
So there's a lot of territory there, isn't it? When you say avoiding the truth.
Yeah.
Did you realise very early on you were gay?
Yeah, well, I certainly realised very early on. Without, that word didn't really exist. The word that we had at the time was queer, which, you know, sounds in those days anyway, it didn't sound very nice. And I'd only ever heard of same-sex situations in an abusive context. So there was never any kind of a positive, oh, that's Patty and Johnny, and they live at the top of the road, and they're quote-unquote bachelors, and, you know, and they're pillars of the community, and so on and so forth. Anytime we ever heard about guy-on-guy stuff, it was always in a really horrible, abusive context. And, of course, the irony is, as we know, what's been uncovered from the Catholic Church, but that's another program entirely. I would just say that certainly for me, what I knew was I wasn't like the other boys at the same time. I wasn't quite sure what was going on, because I do have that wonderful contradiction of absolutely adoring the company of women, the company of girls. I spent a lot of time with girls when I was younger because, frankly, they were better crack. Their games were more interesting, more complicated, and they were emotional. They cared about you. They asked you what was wrong with you. The only time that fellas in my community touched each other was at a fight or a funeral, and if you weren't any good at football, you may as well not exist.
So what was it like suppressing those feelings? How did it make you feel about yourself?
Well, Stephen, suppressing anything of that magnitude is ultimately really exhausting. And detrimental, I think, ultimately. And so, yeah, I mean, you spend a lot of your time, and even now, you know, as an adult now, I can see just how much work it must have taken to constantly cover it up, to constantly try and be one of the boys, and failing very badly at it.
And then you have that defining moment, presumably, in your life where you decide, you know what, I'm not hiding this anymore, I am going to be me.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, big moment.
Yeah, it's a world-changing moment. And, of course, there's no map to that moment. You just, every person is different, that kind of thing. And we all kind of crystallize, and we all, like any kind of butterfly or cocooned situation, there's no time limit to these things. But ultimately, the sooner, I think, anybody out there comes out, the better, because you live a more authentic life, you know. And I think it is absolutely exhausting. And it's really telling in other people who haven't fully embraced themselves. And things like weight gain, I mean, certainly when I was at my most unhappiest, I was probably heavier than I am now, things like that. And I think all those things are connected to feeling happy and having an armour against the world. However, as you know, Stephen, growing up in a place like Belfast, where there are other things, like it was a crime to be a Catholic at that point, never mind a gay one. So, I mean, you know, you have to pick and choose your fights.
How old
and
were
I
you?
And I realised I had to kind of basically go to London to have any kind of fresh air about it, you know.
How old were you when you came out, Bron?
My mates kind of knew around 17, 18. Some of my mates knew that, and that was quite brave of me at the time. And then later on, I suppose I came out properly to my parents in my 20s.
And how did they react? How do you come out to your parents? What do you? I don't want this whole interview to be about this, but it's interesting territory. And you talk so openly and so confidently about it.
Yeah, sure. But I understand that I also have a, given that there are so few of us, Stephen, that are out in the media, especially from Northern Ireland, I do feel a slight responsibility to anybody who's listening out there who might be grappling with this.
So how did you approach your parents?
I decided I would do that wonderful thing where I thought, well, maybe my dad will be the most difficult person to talk to first, and because he's also a man. So I decided I would tell him first. And I worded it kind of like this, where I said, look, in the future, when I have a partner, it'll probably be a man. And the silence that just happened there was akin to the silence that happened at the
table.
What
was the look like in his face?
You know, he wasn't looking at me. He was looking sort of in any other direction other than at me. And he just went, oh, well, okay, I didn't say too much about it, really. It wasn't met with any great reaction. I was prepared for, you know, all eventualities, but it was actually not met with any real reaction. But I think that that's indicative of a lot of men of that generation, where you just kind of internalize a lot of stuff, you know. And my mother, similar kind of thing, and it wasn't until I went back to London, where I was living at the time, when, you know, everything really hit the fan, and, you know, it was absolutely outside their experience. So they just, all they had and all, and a lot of people had at that time in terms of the dictionary that were handed, Stephen. You know, when you look up that word, all you can find are negative connotations. So certainly what I had to do was just reinvent that word and reestablish myself. I liken it to when you're handed a pair of trousers or a coat or a shirt from an elder brother down the generations. By the time you get to that shirt, it's been worn. It doesn't really fit. You don't really want it. And the same was true of me and the word gay, because it had been so defined so negatively. By the time I decided that I might be that tiny little word as well for such a huge emotional feeling, that I just thought, well, that doesn't fit me. What does gay mean? That doesn't fit me. It's too small.
And eventually, did that draw you closer to your parents telling them, or push you further apart?
I think it was just one thing on a journey. I'm not close. I'm only close to one brother, actually, called Stuart, who's a sweetheart. So, you know, I think within lots of big families, you either grow up really close as a consequence, or you go out into the world and find your own space. And for me, that's what happened. I was not like the other kids. And as far as I know, I'm the only gay child. My singing took me in a very particular direction.
See, that's
and really
interesting.
I left home properly at 16.
You've got one hell of a story to tell, Bran, because that's interesting territory again itself. Let's come away from the gay issue now. But
sure.
But not being close to your parents is massive for any human being in itself. What's that like?
It is, but at the same time, it's you know, whatever nature program you watch also, I've been seeing a lot of nature programs recently where it's actually the most natural thing in the world is to go into the world. You know, one of the things, maybe the greatest gifts that any parent can do is prepare a child for the world in terms of being able to survive by yourself.
But, Brian, some of the preparation for the world, from where I sit, is having those pillars. My dad is dead now. Mum's still alive. Mm-hmm. Them letting you know that they are there for you no matter what as a pillar.
Yeah. I loved your tweet recently, Stephen, where you had your hair cut a wee bit too short, and your first thought was, "Oh my God, what will my mother say?"
Well, precisely, but precisely, and I'm a 38-year-old man saying that. I'm thinking to myself, how more difficult is life for someone like you?
Yeah.
Who doesn't have that mum figure or dad figure to say, do you know what? Those pillars are there, and I've got that love, and I've got that support, and I've got that acceptance.
Yes.
Are you sure you haven't missed that at all?
Well, I think you never know what you miss if you don't have it, you know? I mean, certainly, like I said, I've been such an independent little fella since a very, very early age. I copped on very quickly that I was kind of, you know, I was kind of on my own from a very early age, but of course I was within this family. You know, all I can say is it's what I'm used to. It's what I'm comfortable with. It's what I've grown up with. And you just kind of, you make your way in the world. And honestly, it's the thing that set me apart from everybody else. And it's also the thing that's allowed me to blossom.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's like any overplanted situation. You either get caught up in the weeds for your whole life, or you set yourself apart and blossom. And that's, I think, what's happened to me as an adult, for sure.
So as this independent, then, young man, that drive has to be there to survive, and presumably that drive has helped you with your career and helped you get to the stage you're at.
No question. I mean, this is, of course, the wonderful benefit of hindsight. I see, absolutely, that it was a huge part of me being able to just literally overnight move to a different country, move into a squat, you know, and get into all sorts of difficult situations and be able to survive, and not only survive, really blossom and really come into my own and take on difficult situations. Like a wee fella like me from the Falls Road, having grown up in all those situations and suddenly having a record company meeting with RCA Records. I'm on my own and those kind of things. And
wow.
I do better.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's exciting. You're sitting there with record executives.
I know. And I'm like 22, right? And it's only, you know, a couple of years after having moved to London. I'm in the label that signed Elvis Presley. You know, I remember that weird feeling. This label signed Elvis Presley, and here I am, and they want to make an album with me. I mean, I could believe it, and I couldn't believe it at the same time. It was extraordinary.
And from there, you continue to flourish. Like, if you look at what you did, you were performing with Van Morrison at a very early stage of your career, right?
Yes, yes.
And then you did
that for 6 years.
And then you shared the global stage with many greats, you can tell us.
Yeah, I mean, through Van, I got to sing with him and Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell. We toured with Ray Charles. I mean, extraordinary situations. I mean, weird things like Richard Gere came and played in the band for a week on guitar, just, you know, for fun. And so, you know, no matter what happened and what was thrown at us, we survived. And again, I think that's testament to the kind of little fella I started off being. I think if you can cope with that threat of death and that threat of all of the things that happened on the Falls Road, certainly then fast forward to Madison Square Gardens, where I'm standing there singing in harmony with Van Morrison and Bob Dylan.
Incredible.
It is extraordinary, really.
Incredible. And you must have felt a sense of pride in yourself.
I do and I don't. I mean, I'm a great one for kind of just being in the moment and then moving on. It's like I say to you, it's only when I do little interviews like this with you, because I know you're fascinated by what makes people tick, as am I. I just think, well, God, yeah, I see it now that I'm talking to you, Stephen, about it. I think, yeah, God, there's a wonderful Joni Mitchell song where she says, that there's a line in the verse where she says, I see a stray, you see a stray in the wilderness, and I see how far I've traveled. And so I love that kind of juxtaposition there of the character. And I think that sums up what we're talking about.
Can I ask you just finally about Northern Ireland?
Sure.
Because it's very dear to me. It's undoubtedly very dear to you. Where do you think we're at in Northern Ireland at the moment? Obviously, there's a big drive on this year, 2012, Our Time, Our Place.
Yeah.
What do you
think?
I mean,
I think we're at a very interesting moment. I think it's a bit of a high wire act where you're kind of, we're certainly elevated, but it's scary, where you think that you're kind of walking a very thin line and looking down at what could be a massive fall. At the same time, I think we have to take very brave steps. And they are happening. My goodness me. For me to stand there in the Lyric Theatre, first of all, the gem that is that beautiful new building, and for me, again, to come from the Falls Road, to stand in that space, to meet, you know, all of the people that were there that day, including Queen Elizabeth. She came around, she shook my hand, she offered me her hand first. If you'd have said to me as a little boy, terrified on the way to school, that one day, Brian, you'll grow up and the Queen of England will shake your hand and have a warm, friendly conversation with you, and her wee sparkly eyes and everything. I mean, if that doesn't tell us everything, and to witness Martin McGuinness shake hands with her, things like that, I mean, my goodness. I mean, certainly we have a way to go, but what wonderful strides we're making. It's incredible.
I should have really asked you actually about that when we were talking about sexuality, that here in Northern Ireland, I've covered this story both here and then on Five Live in the UK. So here in Northern Ireland, you know, gay people who have had sex are permanently banned from giving blood. Throughout the rest of the UK, they essentially said that's absolutely...
Well, I'll tell you a better story.
That's nonsense. How do you feel as a man born in Northern Ireland with that legislation, and the Health Minister, Edmund Poots, has recently stood by it and said he is not changing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's outrageous. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I went to apply for my mortgage all of those years ago, I had to have a HIV test in front of the doctor. The doctor then also had to, if he wanted to, witness me giving a urine sample so he would know that it was definitely my urine. And ultimately, I had to wait. I mean, what a way to find out if you were positive, but of course I was not in the end. Those are the kind of things that were the legislation that was in order. And let me tell you this, some of the most sexually active people I know are heterosexual people. You know, and they're not gay people. Gay people are educated people. We know what it's, you know, in terms of the HIV thing that's going on. There's been a fall in infection, things like that, because we're educated. Condoms are a big, certainly a very big part of my sexual life, for a start.
So when you hear that news that gay people in Northern Ireland are banned from giving blood to someone they want to help, what goes through your head?
Well, I mean, it's utterly ridiculous. I mean, you know, it couldn't be further away from what we need in terms of blood. You know, decent blood, as we know, is scarce enough. I think it's just, you know, homophobia by another name is all it is. And we do need education and to be woken up about it. So, I mean, hopefully even us having this conversation, Stephen, on the airwaves will make other people think about it.
And then, of course, the other territory is that, you know, Scotland, we're looking just over recent days at...
Yes.
There are politicians talking about same-sex marriage, and there's a huge debate going on throughout the United Kingdom.
Yeah, well, I'm a big part of the push for same-sex marriage. Obviously, I'm based in Dublin at the moment, and I'm part of the LGBT community and part of that drive. I just sang at Gay Pride a few weeks ago. I'm singing at Pride in Newry very soon as well. And again, it's just I feel a responsibility to stand up and be seen. The theme this year for Pride was Show Your Colours. And I just think that's part of what I'm doing.
And yet, Brian, some churchgoers who object to it think that they've got to fight to protect the heritage and God's word. of the church.
Well, I mean, I suppose the greatest irony, and I suppose maybe the bitterest pill for a lot of people who've stood by the church all this time, are seeing just the extraordinary things that are coming to light, like the cover up of all of that child rape, all of that kind of stuff, you know. And it's just, it must be such a bitter pill for them to swallow. At the same time, I don't want to insult anybody's faith. I think faith is very, very, very important. But again, I would just say, like, look to your own home. Nobody's innocent here. Nobody's guilty here either. And just because somebody happens to love someone of the same sex, for goodness sake, it's 2012. Wake up. This is the world that we live in.
Just as we draw to a close, tell me about tell me about your dreams. Tell me about your aspirations, your dreams in life as to what you still want to do. Specifics. You know, do you want to travel to a certain country? Do you want to have children? What do you want to do?
I mean, I'm very, very optimistic about the future. And again, I would thank the Falls Road for that too. I want to get better at what I do. I want to make more records. I want to sing with more people, write more books, travel more places in the world. I've never been to Hawaii. I've never sung with Aretha Franklin. I would love to do all of those kind of things and just keep pushing the boundaries.
Really enjoyed talking to you today, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.